Welcome to The Gathering Resources. The following audio is from our breakout session entitled Alleluia for Algorithms: How Might Christians Embrace and Shape a Technology-Fueled Future? This session features Frank Chin and Ben Choi.
Welcome, everybody. Thanks for finding your way through the desert to the far off Santiago courtyard. Okay, this session is titled Alleluia for Algorithms. And I'm going to just read the first intro to the description because Josh and his team did such a good job with this. So here we go. In one caricatured corner, capitalists in Silicon Valley worship at the altar of technological advancement as the solution to all human conditions. There's an app for every problem. In the other corner, Christians in prayer circles decry the fall of humanity as the devil disguises himself in data and devices. There's sin in every bite. You see what he did there, I love it. So I think because of that description, according to the app, this is like the most popular session. So thank you for writing such an awesome intro. My name is Ben Choi. It's so fun to be back in person at the gathering. My partners and I help run a firm called Legacy Venture, where we invest in venture capital firms. And I'm so excited to be with my friend Frank, who's one of the firms we get to invest in. We invest on behalf of a group of philanthropists who agree to give all the investment away to charity. To give you a sense of it, over the last 18 months, if you've heard, the stock market has done well, and technology investments have done well. And we've been able to distribute over $700 million to the charities that many of you support. So it's a pretty incredible time in the world. Thanks. We're excited to be part of that story. So let me see. What else am I supposed to do besides introducing my friend? So Frank is really the main speaker today. He is a founding partner at Andreessen Horowitz. For those of you from kind of outside Silicon Valley, Andreessen Horowitz is kind of like the Goldman Sachs of venture capital. So just kind of, is that fair? Is that good or bad? Yes, it's meant to be good. It comes with a bit of the bad. It's the firm. And they're only 10 years old, but they really have established themselves as the preeminent venture capital firm. And Frank was there when it was just the four of you, right?
Yes, I have my dented table from Home Depot to prove it before we had furniture.
On the topic, Frank actually came to Andreessen Horowitz with a career in technology startups, and he trained in computer science, actually in kind of the esoteric version of computer science at Stanford. So he studied AI and actually has something to teach us about it. So I'm looking forward to that. But I found something common in our careers. One of your first jobs was at a company called Go Corporation, which was an early tablet computing startup. And this is in the 90s, before this thing existed. It was a spectacular failure. From what I understand.
Raised $100 million.
$100 million from Mitch Kapoor, I think, a lot of it, early days.
Mitch was the, yep.
And your CEO went on to write a book called Startup, which chronicled the story of this startup and the spectacular rise and fall. I was in college at the time when he wrote that book. I read it, and it was the first time I heard the word venture capitalist, or really like product management and startup, and it set me on the path for me to get into startups and ultimately into venture capital. And so it's a fun little coincidence we share.
That is a fun connective tissue.
So I'm gonna turn over to Frank to kind of open us up on this topic.
Well, thank you so much for having me. This is my first gathering. Josh is in the back. He's bravely invited a first timer to two events at the gathering. So I think he's back there trying to decide if he's gonna actually put me on tomorrow night. Yeah. So I'm gonna need big applause, I think, to earn my second slot. Yeah. Josh is watching. Well, thanks so much. I did indeed study artificial intelligence in the late Stone Age, and it was deeply, deeply unpopular back then. I didn't know. I was, 18 years old. What did I know? I just wanted to know how the brain worked because I've always been fascinated by this. So when you think about something that is fearfully and wonderfully made, like think about the brain. Like this 5-pound organ in your body draws something like 5 watts of power allows you to do everything that you do, right? And how does it work? And I wanted to go learn. Artificial intelligence then was sort of esoteric. It didn't go anywhere, but maybe about 10 years ago, it sort of lit back up, and I'm having what I call my revenge of the nerds moment, right? Which is the things that I studied 25 years ago now are all of a sudden relevant. And so I thought I'd come share a little bit about it. So if you read the popular press about artificial intelligence, there's basically two main through lines. One through line is algorithms are evil, and it's how we sold our country to the Russians in the last elections, right? Which is algorithms all of a sudden became a dirty word. This weird computer science term became part of the popular consciousness, and it's sort of the root of all evils, right? The reason that we're in our own echo chambers, the reasons that we can allow people to have influence over our kids, like their algorithms. So that's one through line. And then there's sort of another through line, which is, okay, so not only is it creating echo chambers, but it's gonna create mass unemployment, which is to say every job will get automated by artificial intelligence. And then, you know, sort of the more fanciful people, after we're all unemployed because the machines are doing the jobs, then Skynet comes for your children, right? Like that's the press, right? That's how we read about artificial intelligence and its impact. Now, for those of us who are working every day in the field, we have a very, very different view of it, which is we're funding startups that are using machine learning and artificial intelligence to do awesome, life-affirming things in the world. And I'm just gonna share a couple examples because these are the things that you don't hear in the press. So I'm gonna talk about, like, look, all of these uses of machine learning, we're all like, let's do that, right? So one example is there is a drone company that will deliver blood and COVID vaccines to areas that the trucks can't get to, either because the roads are bad or there's rebels in the way in Rwanda. So Zipline is this company. A doctor can literally in an app say, I need 2 liters of O-neg. And then half an hour later, a drone will fly by, they'll parachute the blood into the field and save somebody's life. That's artificial intelligence. And I'll tell you a funny story from one of the doctors who had this experience. This is a funny story about human psychology. The first time the doctor does this and the blood comes out of the sky in a parachute, he sits and he's like, it is as if Jesus Christ himself, the skies opened up. Jesus Christ delivers this blood and saves this patient's life. So that's the first delivery. A month later, he's looking at his watch. My blood is late. Why? Why is my blood late? A little story about human psychology there. But machine learning makes that possible. Another example, there are lots of regions in the world where the banks don't serve the bottom half of the population because there's no credit file on them. So the banks have no idea, can I make a loan safely to this person or not? There's no credit bureau. And so we use artificial intelligence machine learning algorithms. There's a company called Branch. And they look at your behavior on the phone to guess whether you're gonna repay your loan, right? So brand new behavior. So here's fun facts from people more likely to repay their loans. If you are a really good shepherd of your battery, in other words, you don't burn through your battery the first 3 hours, you are more likely to repay your loan. Huh, right? If you receive more texts than you send, you are also more likely to repay your loan. So this one is kind of obvious. For anybody who's worked in an organization, you know the more senior people, they write very short emails. The junior people are writing volumes, right, for the senior people, and the senior people are like, yes, do it, agree, fine, right? And so that translated into the life of these people is exactly the same phenomenon, which is senior people who are plugged into their community and respected, they write short little things, right? And so if you text, if you receive more text. Now here is a fascinating one, which I think none of us would have guessed. If you have gambling apps on your phone, you are more likely to repay your loan, right? I would have guessed the exact opposite, but this is sort of part of the beauty of machine learning, which is sometimes human intuition is not the right intuition. I have no idea why gamblers are more likely to repay their loan, they just are. And so if we can harness that insight and make these loans, right, we'll start at 50 cents and we'll eventually work up to $5 and $10 and $50. we can jumpstart a whole ecosystem of lending where people couldn't get those loans before, right? Everybody wants that to happen, right? Let's get money in the hand of entrepreneurs in a way that was not possible before, right? Made possible by machine learning. Let me give you one last example. This is sort of maybe one of my favorite examples. And Ben wanted to make sure I didn't only describe our portfolio companies because Zipline and Branch are. So this one's
no,
outside.
No selling from the stage.
Right? Yeah, yeah. No, this is one not one of ours. But this is a team that built the Microsoft Word ribbon. For those of you that know, like the ribbon is that, you know, sort of area of real estate in Microsoft Word. They went out and started a company called Textio. And what Textio does is it looks at you writing your job description. It analyzes the people who apply to those jobs, and it will alert you if you're writing your job description in a way that is sexist. In other words, you're writing the job description in a way that's going to attract more men than women, or it's going to turn off particular groups because they have all of the data. And so in real time, you're typing this job description and it'll sort of have this gender meter on it, which is, hey, you may not have known this, but you're gonna turn off women applicants to your job by writing these words. That's amazing. That's of course what we want, right? Which is we have our own biases amplified by the sin nature. We need machine learning to help correct us because we're embedded in a culture, in a matrix that we don't understand. And so Zipline and Branch and Textio are just examples of like, this is fantastic. This has nothing to do with Skynet coming for your children. That has nothing to do with unemployment. This is helping us be better humans, which is exactly what we want. So day to day, this is sort of what I experience, right? Which is machine learning is trying to make our lives better. It's trying to make human thriving, you know, sort of more thriveful. And we can do that. But what we wanted to talk about this morning, so like, okay, somewhere between Skynet comes for your children and this long, long list of awesome things that machine learning is doing, there is a lot of nuance and gray area, and that's what we wanted to have the bulk of this conversation on, and sort of maybe just to motivate a single example. I think a lot about this because I'm fascinated by this technology. Thinking about self-driving cars and the application of that technology to long-haul trucking. So we all here have a spiritual principle that we try to live in our lives, which is love your neighbor as your health, as yourself, and defend the oppressed, defend the poor. So now I'm thinking about the truck driver in the cab. So here's two things that's true about that truck driver. The average long-haul truck driver's life expectancy is 15 years lower than the national average. Their job is literally killing them, right? And you don't have to have a very vivid imagination to understand why that is the case, right? Which is they're on the road all of the time. They can't eat healthy. Like you go to a truck stop and try to eat like something healthy, right? The stress of being away from your family for that long, life expectancy is 15 years lower. So if I want to defend this person, I would put an algorithm in the cab and have the algorithms drive the truck. So that, great. On the other hand, that algorithm, that set of technologies, has taken this man's job, or this woman's job. It's mostly men. And so how should we think about that as Christians? Because on the one hand, we're trying to defend this poor, oppressed person who is literally going to die 15 years earlier than another person in the population because of the job that they have, right? And so is my principle as a Christian, I need to get the algorithms into that cab as soon as possible so that this person can be freed up to do something else that doesn't kill him 15 years earlier then? Or is my duty as a Christian to sort of defend him from that technology, which is this is this man's livelihood. We cannot take it away from him. What is he gonna do if he cannot drive that truck? How is he gonna provide for his family? And so this is the gray area that we wanted to spend most of this time on, which is it is a gray area. And I think as Christians, we need to sort of engage in a way that is spirit-led and loving, but it's not at all obvious how to do that.
Do you want a hat? You're in the sun.
I would love a hat.
Do you want?
I've forgotten how to travel, so I'm glad I remembered my toothbrush, but I did manage to forget my sunscreen.
I almost forgot my toothbrush.
I feel better now.
You look good.
Yeah. Is this on backwards?
No, it's oh, okay, it's great. Okay, okay. You make it look good.
All right.
I'm a full service investor.
Thank you. Not only an LP, but bringer of the hats. I appreciate that.
So I know that everyone here comes from, the wonderful thing I love about this community is we share our faith and we share a heart of generosity to give. I also love that there are a handful of tech insiders in this community, folks that we would spend time with on our normal day job, but a lot of folks, and I think most of you, probably not from the tech industry. And so I would encourage you to, can you hear me okay?
No.
Testing? Still not.
Louder.
Okay, I'm gonna go back to this. Sorry.
Hold it close back.
All right, testing. So I was just saying that we are from a wide range of backgrounds, particularly on this technology topic, both in personal life as well as professional life. So as we get into it, we're gonna open up for questions or comments, and I really would encourage you to bring it. Bring whatever your thoughts are from both ends of the spectrum. On this topic of self-driving vehicles, autonomous vehicles, two other dimensions that come to mind to me that are interesting, that are nuanced, that are not obvious to me, how people of faith who are trying to influence the kind of direction of society for human flourishing, for the better, it's not obvious what to do. One is the algorithms aren't perfect yet. The cars can almost drive themselves, but not quite. One can argue whether or not humans can drive cars well or not, but the algorithms can't either, right? And they're getting better. And the way you get a car to drive itself better is you have the car drive itself. Kind of like a teenager, right? The way you have a teenager, which terrifies me to have the kids driving cars, but you have to get them to start driving because that's how they get better. And you get them days, months, years in the car, and eventually they become as bad as the rest of us at driving, right? But the algorithms universally are still teenagers. They're not my 12-year-olds, so they're better than it's not terrifying, it's just kind of terrifying. They're teenagers driving the car. How many lives are acceptable to be lost in the process of the algorithms learning to drive cars? And I would, as we talk about cars, replace cars with any other physical object in the world or any other non-physical thing. Self-driving companies, self-driving families. Pick your thing that has a human in leadership that's driving the thing, and imagine that algorithms are helping the humans and in some places replacing the humans. So that's one dimension. How do we train? Mm-hmm. And what affordance do we give technology to get better along the way? Maybe I'll leave it there. I don't know if you've thought about that, because you've seen this over decades where they were not teenagers driving cars. Yeah. They were seeing objects for the first time.
Yeah. Well, I've had this experience as a parent. My last child actually tests next week for his driver's license. I had two before him. So here's sort of an observation, watching my teenagers do it. It's scary every time, right? You get in the passenger seat and you're like, you're losing your mind and you want to hit the brake that non-existent in front of your car. But all the lessons that my oldest son learned didn't transfer to my youngest son. He had to learn from scratch. So that leads to the observation that the only way we're gonna get to the minimum number of accidents, right, on the planet is through algorithms. Because every time an algorithm makes a mistake, we can go debug that thing and make sure that never happens again, and then we can transmit all of that learning to the rest of the fleet, right? So I don't know of a way to do that with humans. I only know of a way to do that with algorithms. And so if you believe that, then you believe that as regular, like imagine that you were the Department of Transportation chair trying to decide who can start a self-driving trial. If you believed what I just said, you would say max trials, which is let's get as many self-driving trials in the world as possible. And you know full well, as the administrator making that decision, people are gonna die. There's no question, right? And we can parse whether it's the algorithm's fault or if it's crazy driver's fault or crazy pedestrian's fault. Like I imagine like most of them will be crazy us, as opposed to bad algorithms.
Or crazy engineers. Incompetent engineers.
It could be incompetent engineers, for sure, right? There's the sin nature, you make a mistake, we all make mistakes. But I imagine most of them are gonna be unanticipated behavior because we're crazy. So here's the thought experiment. If you could take a city, wave a magic wand, replace every single vehicle with a self-driving vehicle, I think we're ready today with the algorithms we have. The thing that makes the algorithms not ready is unanticipated behavior from you and me, right? It's the crazy things that we do. And so if you are trying to minimize the number of lives lost, you have to sort of like go as fast as you can with the algorithms, get as many trials in the universe, and then the price that you pay is people will die at the hands of these algorithms, and then how should we think about that? And I think the right way to think about that is we can't think about it in isolation, which is, did the algorithms kill somebody? If yes, then continue trial. If no, then stop trial. I think the way we need to think about that is how many total people are gonna be injured or killed down this path versus down the human path? And the conversation needs to embrace that fundamental math. Otherwise, we're thinking about it wrong. And so if we're thinking, like, should we wait until algorithms are perfect? I think we've waited too long, right? We've got to lean into these things because we're trying to minimize the number of total deaths from this point on, where it's now remotely possible for the cars to drive themselves, to the point where we have as few accidents as we can engineer.
You had asked this, you had posed this interesting question when we were prepping for this, which is, should we extend grace to algorithms? We should extend grace to, we all, that's the one fundamental thing we believe here, we share in common. Humans don't deserve grace, but we get grace from God. So should we extend grace to algorithms? And I think it's related to something else you said about love. Will we ever teach the robot to love? And will we ever agree that we've done it? And without that, I think without that, humans will always be in the loop somewhere.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, extending grace to algorithms is sort of this deeply counterintuitive, you're almost like sick of the stomach on it. So let me sort of paint a spectrum. So let's say there's a terrible accident and somebody gets killed. And then now let me take you into the narrative. What happened? So in one scenario, a well-meaning, adult, alert, not under the influence driver just makes a mistake. And that leads to a death. Very easy to extend grace to somebody because you can imagine that could have been me. I was paying attention. I wasn't texting. I wasn't drunk. I wasn't under the influence. I just made a mistake. It was a terrible, terrible mistake, and I'm deeply sorry for it. Okay, so now move one step here. Let's imagine that it's a teenager learning to drive and they make a terrible mistake. Okay, very easy to extend grace to that. So let's imagine now a fully drunk driver, 2 o'clock in the morning, too many drinks, they run somebody over. It's a little harder to extend grace to that person, right? Where do we put algorithms on this spectrum, right? And I think the intuition is that like, I can't extend grace to that algorithm. Maybe if you push me, I could extend grace to the engineer that wrote the algorithm that failed, that led to the accident. Maybe I could extend grace to that person, but like I will be unforgiving about that algorithm because I expect perfection from that algorithm. In a way, by the way, where we do not expect that from other human drivers. And so like, how should we think about this? And I think as Christians sort of grappling with these types of questions, is gonna be super important as we decide how many self-driving cars in what cities and what scenarios are we gonna sort of let them drive.
So one of the, I think the broader theme behind this self-driving car thought experiment, it's well, reality, is the unintended consequences of technology. And how do we avoid them? How do we avoid, to the extent we can agree that there are certain things we don't desire, how do we avoid those things? And you and I come from a product background, so whenever I think about it, I'm always just, I like to geek out on the companies, and I think about, well, if I were the product manager on it, how would I, if I were the engineer on it, what would I do? And there's certain things you try your best, but ultimately, the product goes into the hands of the user, or in this case, goes out and does its own thing, and things are gonna, there's only so many scenarios that you can foresee. I'm curious, separate from the product, there's also the policy level of, there are unintended consequences that will happen, and you
by definition, they're unintended. So the designers, the makers, the creators, all the folks in Silicon Valley can't avoid them, though they hard they may try. I'm curious how you think about, like, policy level. What are the appropriate ways for the philanthropic or the government sectors to try to manage for those unintended consequences?
Yeah, for me, the North Star, when I have a conversation with policymakers, is human flourishing, which is how do we maximize as much human flourishing as possible, and then how can a policy sort of increase or decrease human flourishing? So we already talked about the self-driving car trials. We know that algorithms are going to run people over, but we need to lean into it because this is the path to zero accidents, right? It's the only known path to zero accidents. Let me give you another example. Which is, let's talk about algorithms recommending whether we make loans to particular people. There are rules, policies, that govern these algorithms, which is you cannot deny a loan based on ethnicity or sexual orientation or those types of things. And so what's sort of the right thing to do around those algorithms? And a lot of people are sort of like, gee, if we let the algorithms decide, we might end up with a distribution of loans that we're uncomfortable with. We might accidentally pick the most loan-worthy people, and then that gets to a basket of loans that, from a Christian or ethical point of view, we didn't want that. It's too many men. It's too many white people. It's too many, whatever it is. But we have this opportunity with algorithms to actually fix this problem, which is imagine this, which is imagine you have a machine learning algorithm. Its only job is to pick likelihood to repay loan, right? Is the loan going to be good or not? So that could be the first filter that we apply to a loan-making decision. The second filter that we can easily apply, if we wanted to set this policy, is here is the basket of loans I want to give out. I want to be even and men, women. I want to be overweight women. I want to be 60% women. And so from this basket of credit-worthy people, I can then go on to stage two, and then I can shape my basket of loans to reflect my desire for the world. So two algorithms together, I think, get us better outcomes from a policy point of view than one algorithm alone. And oh, by the way, it's going to get you better outcomes than just letting people and banking underwriting rules make decisions. Because look, we've had these redlining laws. These are what the policies that say, you can't deny a loan to a black person or this neighborhood or whatever, right? We've had these laws on the books for decades now. And yet, if you read studies today of whether loan making is racist, the answer is yes. Because ultimately, it's humans making these decisions. They might be helped by algorithms. But like, the sin nature is in us. It's in us. And so can we get algorithms to help blunt the worst effects of the sin nature? And I think the answer is yes. There's a lot of silent racism that goes on inside a bank underwriting officer's decision making, and we can bring the light of day to it with algorithms, right? This two-filter algorithm that I described, it allows us to implement the vision of society that we want.
Let's open it up to questions. Fred, give us a hard one.
Uh-oh.
No, not, hey, Frank.
Hey, Frank, how are you? That is a great question, and it's very related to the question that we think about as investors all day long, because philanthropy and investors are all about impact, right? On the investors' front, you're trying to figure out which of the companies could we fund that would become the biggest companies, right? And as a philanthropist, you're thinking about which are the nonprofits or causes that we could support that would support the most human flourishing, right? So we have tried to build algorithms for ourselves to identify good candidates to invest in. And you know, we've been at it 10 years, so it's not that long that we've been in. And what we found is it's a very difficult thing to outsource to an algorithm today. And the reason for that is the data set available to you to make these decisions is very, very small, right? Which is, what would you try to decide whether a company is a good company or not? You could look at the founder and their backgrounds and whether they had built products before, whether they had a successful company in the past. You could look at education outcomes. You could do those things. But you know, when we meet and put money into founders, sometimes it's really just the two of them and a trick dog, right? There's no history, there's no quarterly reports, there's no impact, there's no product market fit, you just don't know. And so in a domain where you don't have a lot of reliable data, then the sorting algorithms get very, very tricky, right? Which is you're not gonna get very high quality results because it's garbage in, garbage out. Now, having said that, in philanthropy land, you can actually look at a body of organizations that have been up and running for a long, long time. So you don't have, you could avoid that, right, by saying, I won't fund a startup nonprofit. I will only fund somebody who has 5-10 years of operating history. But then the same questions apply, which is, how will I determine effectiveness, right? What is the metric that I'm going to use to normalize? And that's a hard, tricky thing. Right, which is, lives impacted? I know Scott was here yesterday. Is it like liters of water pump? But like, if it's liters of water pump, then like nobody else has that metric, and so how would I compare him against another? Is it like flourishing? But like, man, if somebody could come up with a flourishing metric, right, that would be universally agreed upon, that would be something. But I don't know how to do that, right? And so we have to just be mindful of the limitations that we have. When we try to put algorithms, sort of to solve these sort of inherently taste and creative and out of the box and not easy to measure things. And so I would just say, let's have healthy respect for what the algorithms can and cannot do. Because we've been trying to, algorithm to fund startups and we don't know how to do it.
The distinction between a self-driving car and a fully instrumented car is a very fine line. I don't trust a self-driving car with my own family yet, but my car beeps at me when I start to shift off the lane, or it tells me if I'm getting too close to the car in front. I think it's similar for investing. I think it's similar for philanthropy, where you don't have to. The question isn't when do we have the robots do our grants for us. It's how do we use technology to be better at trying to have the impact. And I think it's the same in investing. 20 years ago, when two Stanford PhDs were working on a new search algorithm, they were working in a garage of some successful tech executive. That was the space they could afford. Larry and Sergey were working away, and VCs would come get introduced to them because the tech executive that was housing them knew the VCs. Larry and Sergey were PhD students at Stanford, and they didn't know anybody. Back then, in the venture ecosystem, you had to know somebody, and it worked really well. They funded Google, and Google is kind of important to all of us. So the model kind of worked well and had impact, you could say, helped human flourishing. You could argue that there's other unintended consequences as well. Today, I'd argue that your firm and your peers work hard to capture those opportunities through the relationships you have, but also use technology, not to make the decision to invest, but to make sure that you're seeing the other two founders and the trick dog that don't happen to know a wealthy philanthropist or some successful tech executive.
Yeah.
Because, and it's a capitalist motivation because it's a good investment, but still it's technology that's kind of extending the reach of you and your partners, as an example. And I think the same can be true for philanthropy, where you can use technology, systems, data, not to necessarily drive the family foundation, but to ensure that you're seeing more than you could, to give you kind of those superhuman powers.
Yeah, that's right.
Yes, Dana.
I'll start out with a quote with Aslan. He's not a safe lion, but he's
not
a good lion.
Not a tame lion.
Right? Yeah. And I'd like you to address this issue of us becoming so risk-averse that we're actually hurting human flourishing. And to think about the self-driving cars and the policymaker that's saying, well, one death would not be acceptable. Couldn't they also develop algorithms and say, how many deaths and injuries will we avoid if we have self-driving cars compared to how many we will have because we're gonna have self-driving cars? Couldn't we also do that with vaccines? I mean, when Johns Hopkins puts out their numbers all the time, couldn't they also be putting out numbers saying, in the United Nations numbers, right? How many people will be dying of poverty because of the lockdowns? And so people can use data to know the safety, you know, risk. So if you could address that aspect.
It's a great point, Dana. Look, framing the debate is 90% of the battle in these policy decisions, right? And I think you're absolutely right. We have to frame it in terms of not will self-driving cars lead to zero accidents tomorrow. We have to frame it in how many other people will die, right? And so vaccines, similarly, how many other people will transmit the disease or go to the hospital because, and so we've got to sort of bring the right data set. So if there's sort of a frame of mind, I think one of the things that the machine learning community has done well is let's bring the right data. Let's make the right comparisons and trade-offs because there are always trade-offs. And then after we sort of look at the data, let's be mindful that our policy decisions have impact on human lives, and so we need a North Star, and as Christians, the North Star has to be loving our neighbors or ourselves, right? It has to be like, how do I support as many people in having, in their lives being as spirit-filled and generous as possible? And, you know, look, you're not gonna be very popular at a policy meeting to bring up the word love, as opposed to bring up the R-squared coefficients. But I think as Christians, we can subtly influence that conversation by always, like, that's our North Star, it's easy. Like, we're all about how do we love our neighbors and ourselves, and then what are the policies that best support that?
And you go to this side. Yes.
If you can use algorithms in bank loan applications, what do you think are the ethical and effective applications of AI algorithms in evangelism and discipleship online?
Yeah.
You know, as an apologist, I think, well, somebody may have questions of historical accuracy of Scripture or of the life of Christ, or some may be hurting and have questions about is God fair? Is God loving? Yeah. You know?
If you want to start, so maybe I'll start. So every big technology leap has given the church a new way to reach a new audience. So the Gutenberg press was the first way that we reached people who would otherwise have to wait until somebody told them the good news in person. There was no other way. And then we got to radio, and a whole legion of evangelists figured out how to take advantage of the radio to reach a new audience. Then we got broadcast television, and evangelists figured out how to take advantage of that medium. Then we got to cable television, and we saw the rise of televangelists. We saw the rise of the internet, and now we've sort of gotten to the point where we've got sort of universal connectivity to people, and then now creative entrepreneurs, social entrepreneurs, pastors are trying to figure out, how do I take advantage of the new medium to reach somebody who has never heard the gospel before, or to encourage a deepening of a spiritual relationship in a way that hasn't been done before. So I know the Bible Project, Jonathan, is coming, is that right? They've done an amazing job of looking at who's visiting our YouTube channel and how could we reach them better. I'm a huge fan of the work that they are doing. The stories they're telling are amazing. And they're using technology to figure out how can I get this amazing story that I've created through animation and text and voiceover into somebody's home who has never seen this before. And they're using the same techniques that companies use, like Facebook, to sort of figure out how do I reach somebody who's like-minded, right? In tech land, they literally call these lookalikes. If you like this person, there's an audience like this person, lookalikes, right? And the great evangelists are trying to use that exact same technology to get the great commission fulfilled. And you know, we look forward to many, many more entrepreneurs who are doing that.
topic of that's growth hacking, and I'd love to come back to that on the unintended consequences. In the interest of time, we only have 5 more minutes. Why don't maybe with 3 more questions in a row, and then we can try to use that as a kind of way to respond. Sure.
I think the thing that concerns a lot of Christians is not the value of algorithms and that, you know, that they have to be perfected, but the way they're being used. I think you see that in social media today. I can give you countless examples I personally know of where, you know, somebody misstepped a PC comment on a social website and all of a sudden they're excluded, or they can't post, or they can't do anything. And it's like if you say something that's somebody tried to start a prayer group and took forever to get validated because the algorithms just kind of kicked them out. That's my concern, is what's the potential for abuse. And the other thing, too, is that I heard some the other day about jobs. There's not enough people to take jobs, and apparently there's a lot of people to take jobs. It's just they didn't fit all the specific categories. And it, like you said, in the past, you know, there was this flexibility where a person, you know, okay, they're a nice guy. They seem to be willing to work. Let's give them a chance. Maybe they don't have this degree. Maybe they don't have that degree. But I think the first is probably the most important question is, what about the abuse of algorithms or the... I'm sure the people who are abusing it don't perceive it as abuse. They think it's just the best thing to do.
Thank you. Any other, not related necessarily, but just, yeah, go ahead.
Somewhat related, but I think if you go to this question of how can we optimize human flourishing, we can't be naive enough to assume that every intended consequence is necessarily positive. And so if these tools themselves are amoral, but then in the hands of different groups or their business models support negative outcomes, to me that has large ramifications, particularly given the global nature and ubiquity of these devices and so on. So my question is, as Christians that are oriented towards human flourishing, what should we do to protect ourselves and our culture and our social fabric from not having these same algorithms be used to manipulate us? And there's, you know, countless examples. I mean, one just the other day was in the Wall Street Journal, where there were documented studies within Instagram and the impact on, you know, human body shaming among teenage girls. Like, objectively awful, objectively not human flourishing, yet persisting, and if anything, even further optimized. So what's the role as the Christian community to step in to ensure that these things are oriented towards human flourishing?
Awesome, thank you. One more. There's one here. Great. Thank you, Haley.
Thank you. Yeah, love the conversation, guys. Thank you. My question's really about, so algorithms are really good at kind of deciding on the highest statistical likelihood of success. It just strikes me that that's not always the way that God operates. We learned yesterday, we heard about, you know, the story of Gideon, and how God kind of whittled the army down to just 300 men. If Gideon was, you know, consulting an algorithm, it would go, hey, most number of soldiers, highest likelihood of success. So how do we leave space for God's wisdom while also using algorithms would be my question. Thank you.
Yeah. And to give you the last minute, go for it.
I didn't want to. Boy, I was not set up to win that one, that's for sure. Where's Josh, has he left? Oh, he's still there, I'm in trouble now. Look, so all three of those questions to me have a common core, which is there's sort of this worry that algorithms are just going to make decisions and we lose all of our agency and there's no room for either creativity or love or flourishing. So for me, the important thing, and Christians have a super important role to play because we need to have a seat at the table, the winning formula to me is algorithm plus human, as opposed to algorithm alone or human alone. I think we need to think about them together so that as humans, we can think about if there is a body shaming thing happening on Instagram, there is also a human group inside Instagram, understanding that, grappling with it, trying to figure out how can we change the algorithm, how can we reduce the effect of algorithms, how can we pick different posts for people to see. And it's going to be a, like, that is to me, like, you've got to bring these people together. And if you're going to do that, if you have algorithms and then you have people looking at the algorithms, trying to make them better, trying to mitigate the downsides of unintended consequences, then it's critical for Christians to be at the table, because it's at that table where we're going to have the arguments about what is human flourishing? What is our North Star? What are we trying to do with the algorithms that we choose to use in these organizations? And if we're absent at that table, then I think what you will get by default, you will get, I need more user engagement because I need more annual revenue per user, and then that's that. And so if we're not at the table to say, you know what, there is more than ARPU, average revenue per user, that we should be grappling with. And so it's critical for algorithms and humans to be working that together instead of us just sort of ceding control to algorithms and assuming that whatever optimization it came up with is the one that we want to live with.
I love the metaphor that Josh painted for us this morning of the table. And I would just reiterate that the worst thing that we could do in the face of these really thorny, nuanced, difficult questions is go set up our own table and just sit amongst the people who agree with us, whoever that is, and just agree and bemoan what's happening. I hope for that at the gathering. I hope for that on this topic. I thank you for coming to this session. I invite you to more conversation. I know that Frank only gets to come back on stage tomorrow if there's wild applause for him. So thank you, everyone.
Josh is still there. Applause for Frank.